Hi, this is Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network today. Scott Craven is back in the studio with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and we're going to be talking about eagles and winter bird feeding and hunting and, of course, always a lot more when Scott's here. Do you have any questions about feeding birds in the winter, or have eagles made a comeback in your area? Why don't you join our conversation? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, and you'll find that at The Larry Mueller Show. And remember, Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. A lot of times people call in and want to know that. So, good to see you, Scott.
It's good to be here. Happy New Year.
You know, you were in last 2 months ago, and Larry had to be off, and people are going to start talking if, you know, we keep meeting like this.
Well, I'll come up with some excuse in 2 months, and we'll keep the trend alive.
It sounds good. Now, at the top of the show, I mentioned that eagles in the 60s and 70s were on the brink of extinction. Why was that? I mean, it's been a while. I think maybe some of us have kind of forgotten.
Well, in those days, there were lots of problems with pesticide contamination and what was referred to as eggshell thinning, when pesticide concentrations caused the shells to be thin and not successfully hatch or unable to hatch. There were problems with rampant shoreline development and not a lot of sensitivity to where eagle nests might have been or not been. And so there were a number of problems that came together. And as you say, eagles were in tough shape, and there was lots of talk and educational programs about doing something for eagles and loons and a lot of other birds at that particular point in history. But now we're at a point where there are near record numbers of eagle nests.
Amazing.
I mean, there wasn't
even
information in some of those years, but this year, for example, in the last time the survey was done, just over 1,500 active eagle nests. So that was up 39 nests from the year before, and you know, figure two eagles per nest, so that's over 3,000 adult eagles right there. When we add all the juveniles and non-nesting birds and whatnot, it's a lot of eagles.
It sure is.
Same basic thing for ospreys, a few less, but this year there were about 558 nests reported on the survey, and that was up 16, I think. But I think the interesting thing there was, in the eagle nests are generally in natural settings, big old white pines or other snag trees in places where you'd expect them, but just in a wider distribution around the state, including here around Madison now, too. But the osprey nests, 75% of those are on man-made structures,
isn't
cell
that amazing?
Phone towers, and apparently the communications companies and power companies as over, they've been very cooperative and tolerant, and osprey seem to take well to those particular sites, and here three-quarters of their nests are on some sort of man-made structure, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, it is neat, because they adapt to what we're doing.
They
so
do.
That's wonderful. Now, we're talking about birds. What kind of species have you been seeing around your bird feeder lately?
Well, at my operation, at least, it's been kind of a typical year. I have a few tufted titmice, which I don't usually have. I like them. I have a pair of red-bellied woodpeckers, which are my favorite birds at the feeder. Beautiful winter birds.
They are, aren't they?
Lots of jays, lots of finches, both goldfinches and house finches. Quite a few chickadees and juncos. A lot of cardinals coming late in the day. Those are kind of the mainstays, and then occasionally something a little more unusual. But the red belly is the main attraction, and feeding peanuts, whole-shelled peanuts to the blue jays is a big attraction for both my wife and the grandkids. They have some sort of a communication mechanism, or they have a blue jay trail camera on the deck, because the door barely closes from a handful of peanuts hitting the deck, and here they come in just a steady progression, and the peanuts are gone within 5 minutes, all
amazing.
To be cached somewhere.
You had mentioned earlier that sunflower seeds are really inexpensive this year.
Well, the prices seem to be better. I remember talking on the program not too many years ago when a 50-pound bag of sunflower seeds was up in the $25-plus range, and holy cow, that's an outrage, and it was getting expensive to feed. I've got 200 pounds, I think, on hand in the garage right now, and that goes quickly.
Yes, it does.
I think I've got five. Anyway, yes. So the bottom line is I bought sunflower seeds for $14 a bag last week.
Excellent.
And they've been routinely on sale for $15, $16, something like that. So good time to put a few bags into storage.
It but is.
They keep them cold and keep them closed, because if you get those... the moths,
yes.
I'm trying to remember what
mm-hmm.
the grain moths or whatever the heck they're called, and those get into the bag, then they'll begin to reproduce and cause problems mm-hmm. in the bag of seeds. So if you're going to pay $15 a bag for sunflower seeds, take care of them and don't let the moths get at them.
Now, is it a good idea to put those in like a metal garbage can too? So
I use either a metal garbage can or... I use big plastic 10-gallon tubs that sometimes things like pool chemicals and whatnot
okay.
come in that I
okay.
clean out, because they have a tight-fitting seal on the lid.
Mm-hmm.
The garbage can lids are sometimes, the metal ones are a little bit loose, and that allows the moths to work their
sure.
way in there. I think the plastic ones where the lid snaps on are probably a little better. But one way or the other, keeping them both free of contamination and easy to get at to fill your feeders are both good things.
Okay. Well, you know what? We've got some calls. And don't forget that you can join our conversation, too. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Kate in the Fox Cities. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love these shows, and I love Scott Craven's visits. I have two questions, and also just a quick comment. We have tons of eagles here in the Fox Valley, and it's really lovely to see how well they've found a home near the open water. So that's really just a great thing. My first question is about the weather and animals. In really harsh conditions like this, I wonder, what do mammals do? We have wolves and coyotes and foxes and so forth. Do they, like our house pets, do they just sort of hunker down, not want to be outside during weather like this? That's my first question. And my second question is about hunting. I don't know how to say it, but how does a person like me determine where it is appropriate for a hunter to be hunting? Every fall, every autumn, I see a hunter right in the middle of a farmer's field, and that field is located it's bordered by a county road on one side, a state highway on the other, and two walking trails on the other side, and yet there's this hunter right in the middle of the field. It always seems a little odd to me that he's there. So how do I check? My second question is, how do I check where hunters can be hunting?
Oh, lots of questions there.
Wow.
For you, Scott.
Well, let's take the hunting question first. It depends a little bit on the municipality or community. Some places that are near urban areas have a minimum acreage requirement for firearms discharge. Some it's permission. It's always essentially permission of the landowner, but sometimes that's enough in a more urbanized community. But seeing a hunter in an open field, regardless of what it's bounded by, it really is important to know what they're hunting. In other words, someone walking through a cut cornfield or a weedy pasture looking for pheasants and hunting with a shotgun, that's perfectly appropriate, and the shot doesn't carry far enough to really be a problem for people passing on the road boundaries that you described. A very different situation if someone's walking through that open field with a high-powered rifle hunting deer, where those bullets are capable of carrying several miles. So it depends a little bit on what they're doing. So that also depends on the time of year, how they're dressed, and a lot of other things that you might be able to interpret from what you see. Most open lands are available to hunting if it's your land or you have permission to be on there. And even if you are driving down the road, see a hunter on a piece of land, and yet on every other fence post there's a big orange sign that says no hunting or trespassing, that really doesn't mean anything because it could be the landowner. They can do whatever they want, or it could be someone on there with the permission of the landowner. All of the land that I hunt deer on that's private land, for example, is heavily posted, but it's still hunted. In fact, I think it's safe to say that the majority of the land that is posted no hunting is in fact hunted in Wisconsin by people who have the appropriate permission. The safety issue is something a little bit aside. In urban areas, there are sometimes considerations made for people involved in managed hunts, say to reduce the deer population in an area where it's a bit of a problem, and normal free-for-all hunting would be inappropriate. So it may be a hunt that's managed in terms of numbers of hunters or the training that they're required to go through or something else. So I guess the bottom line is that's a difficult question to answer, but it's quite possible that seeing someone out in the field the way you did is entirely appropriate, and more likely to be appropriate and okay than to be an issue. There's a lot of responsibility on the hunter to be safe no matter where they are.
Right, and their second question is
the feeding.
Feeding, yeah.
Or at least what mammals are doing in this bitter cold weather that started this morning. We're kind of on a roller coaster this winter.
Oh my gosh, are we?
That's the way things have been going. But in these bitter cold stretches, for some animals, it's business as usual. Deer, for example, are out roaming around looking for feed in exposed fields and whatnot, regardless of the weather. If it's really bad, really windy, a big storm, sure, they'll hunker down and bed down under a tree or in some brush and just wait it out. The middle-sized stuff, the raccoons and possums and fox and coyotes, some of them, like the coyotes and fox, are probably out there hunting no matter what. But raccoons, possums, squirrels, rabbits, in really bad weather, they will just hunker down in a den, a hollow log, in a snowbank, and some heavy brush, and just wait it out. You simply won't see an opossum, for example, in southern Wisconsin in this cold weather. They just won't come out. They're subject to frostbite. Their ears and their exposed little pink naked tails and whatnot will simply freeze off. So they have to be careful. But when we get another thaw, in another week or two, hopefully, they'll be out and about looking for something to eat. The really small stuff in terms of mammals, the shrews and mice and voles and things like that, are all active and going about their business beneath the surface of the snow. They have the toughest time when there's no snow or when it's melted like it has around Madison here now and it's very icy. Then they're exposed and they have to be a little more careful. But a lot of them are active, and they've all grown, for the most part, a heavier coat of fur to help them out a little bit. Some, like some of our bats, have migrated and left the area, and some, like the ground squirrels and a few other things, are hibernating, sleeping it off, waiting for spring. So they all get by. That's the important thing. And although we as people often think that we need to intervene and dump food on the landscape or do something else, the reality is that those animals are adapted to getting through the winter, and generally they will. Without intervention. Now, that's not to say that bird feeding and some other things we do are inappropriate. They're perfectly appropriate for interacting with wildlife, but you shouldn't be too anxious or suffer much anxiety over what most of the animals are doing on a cold night out there right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for that great question, Kate. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Scott Craven is our guest. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guests are going to talk about the role Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka will play in her father's administration. That's at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And here we're talking about wildlife. And Scott, we had a couple of pictures that were posted on our Facebook page. One of an eagle eating a deer. Now, is that normal for eagles to eat roadkill like that?
Well, it's quite normal, actually, and it's a good strategy as far as eagles are concerned. There are we've just kind of come out of the worst period of the year for roadkill deer, with them being pushed around by hunting activity and activities surrounding their normal breeding season during the rut. So there have been lots of dead deer carcasses on the side of the road, and it's as far as an eagle's perspective, it's free lunch. It's actually multiple lunches if they get on the carcass. Now, it's a bit of a problem for the eagles because they're a little slow compared to some birds and not quite as agile getting off the ground or moving. So, unfortunately, there's some risk of them potentially being clipped by a vehicle. But they're also pretty tolerant of vehicles. So they just sit there and, another vehicle going by and go back to dining. So that's actually a pretty common sight, okay. And it's an important food source for the birds.
And that was William who posted that picture, and he also posted a couple of other pictures. What are those of?
Well, that one looks like an osprey.
Is it an osprey?
My feeble eyes are such
that... Yeah, that's what I thought too, but I figured...
We also get... this time of year when the rough-legged hawks come in, we get people seeing very dark, large hawks that are about the size and proportions of a red tail. There are still some red tails around, too, but historically they're kind of replaced in the winter by rough-legs. So.
Well, there's some really nice pictures, so if you can, get on Facebook and take a look. But let's go back to the phones right now. We've got Janet from Milwaukee. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I thought I would mention that this year... at my family cottage in East Troy, Wisconsin, we actually saw a bald eagle fishing in the lake. We have a little little cottage on Booth Lake, which is right by Beulah. And we've never seen that before. He actually did a dive, and it didn't look like he caught a fish, unfortunately. But does that mean he lives nearby?
Well, nearby is sort of a relative term when you're an eagle and you can fly pretty easily from point to point. Some will go quite a ways from where they... Well, let's backtrack a little bit. These birds will have, especially in the warm season, kind of a resident lake where they'll spend most of their time. But they certainly roam around the countryside. In terms of where they live, the only thing they're really tied to, in a very specific sense, is the nest site. So for nesting birds, they will headquarter at the nest site and then move out to the lake they're on or surrounding lakes, wherever the fishing seems to be best for them. During the winter months, they tend to congregate near sources of food. So that's why we have concentrations in Prairie du Chien and Pettenwell along the Wisconsin River, where dams and flowages keep the water open, and there's a source of fish. And a lot of our eagles that don't hang out at these Wisconsin sites move further south and congregate on big wildlife refuges where there are tens or hundreds of thousands of waterfowl in southern Illinois and Kentucky and places like that. So they will spread out to where there's a food source. That's what concentrates them in the winter months. In the summer, they're keyed to their nests. But it wouldn't be unusual for an eagle to fly miles to a good food source.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Janet, for the call. Excuse me. Let's go to David in Wausau. Hi, David.
I have to go. Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
It's always a pleasure listening to you, Scott. I work on a rural delivery route in Marathon County. And yesterday, this is kind of just a little aside, I saw six hunting hawks, two midair and four in trees, and it was 31 degrees, and I'm thinking to myself, those guys, I know the cold snap's coming. And that was kind of fun. But my question is about eagles. Early on, before any of the water was closed up here, it might have been a first dusting of snow, I saw, and they were low enough for me to make a positive identification, I saw nine eagles soaring together like vultures would. But like I said, I made a positive ID on them, and I've never seen that before. They were in the middle of a cornfield. Were they migrating together? And maybe you could talk a little more about their social habits when they group up. And thanks again for a great show.
Sure, thank you. Well, the only thing we didn't come up with, I don't question that they were eagles, but I wonder if they were adults or juveniles that may have some bearing. But usually if there's a number of birds, eagles, circling over anything, it's a food source. They may have been a group of eagles from a particular lake or flowage or whatever in the northern part of the state that were working their way starting south to one of these other concentration points that we just talked about. They could have also been a group of eagles that were behaving somewhat vulture-like. I hate to equate eagles with vultures, but who knows? If this was around the deer season and there was a deer carcass out in the middle of that field they were circling over, then it was a gathering for a lunch party, so to speak. So there are a couple possible explanations. They're not a particularly social bird, especially during the nesting season, but they put aside any of their personal differences or disagreements later in the year when they're concentrated in potentially large numbers by the dozens at these food sources that we talked about a few minutes ago. So the fact that there might be 15 or 20 eagles in a tree over near Prairie du Sac for Eagle Days coming up is a function of, hey, this is a good place for an eagle to be, and the fact that I've got to be willing to share it with my 19 or 20 closest friends here in the tree is somewhat irrelevant. They're there because of the conditions and not necessarily because their buddies are there. Their buddies are there for the same reason.
Sure. And we're going to be talking about Eagle Days next Wednesday, so if you're interested, make sure you tune into that. Our guest is Scott Craven. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and we've got some open lines if you've got a question for him. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, and of course you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Jan in Monticello. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hi. Scott, I have a question regarding foxes. I've lived on the edge of our village for the last 5 years, and we have a lot of rural land around our area, and there's been a fox that has lived right in our subdivision, and she had kits, and all the time she was here, I never had any rabbit damage at all. And now I haven't seen her for the last 6 months. And I don't know if somebody trapped her or shot her or she just died. But this year, the rabbits are just decimating my shrubs and anything they can eat. And my question is, why is there open season on foxes? Because they are beneficial in that they control the rabbit population, feral cats, mice, etc. And how long do they live? And do they hibernate? And I just want to know, too, about the open season.
Well, first, are we talking about a red fox or a gray fox?
A red fox.
Okay. Well, it's it's pretty common for a red fox to set up shop in what we think of as suburban or urban areas. There's a very popular canid research or dog family research project going on right here in Madison on campus dealing with coyotes and red fox, and people really like them. They're a beautiful animal, especially in the winter when their pelts are prime and all that flowing orange-red hair and big tail and all make them very attractive. The fact that they provide some ecological services by mousing or keeping the rabbit population down is a side benefit. And generally, as long as people leave them alone, they do just fine in that environment. One of the reasons they may be in that environment are because they're pushed in there by pressure from some of their fellow members of the dog family, like coyotes. Coyotes and red fox don't play well together. But the fact that you had one in the neighborhood is not at all uncommon. They're usually a source of some neighborhood pride. The fact that it disappeared could be due to a whole variety of factors. You asked about their longevity, and it's a few years. I mean, there are lots of things that can affect these animals, obviously, from disease problems and mange and whatnot, to probably the most likely fate for an urban animal is car traffic. So, I mean, we'll never know what happened to that animal. It may have just moved on, but that's not one of the more likely explanations. It's more likely that it fell to some type of accidental death, and it's gone. Whether one of its offsprings will fill that void, you'll just have to wait and see. I'm not sure that even the presence of the fox could have held the rabbits down this year. It was a very good year for rabbits.
It certainly was.
It was a warm, wet year. There was tons of vegetation to conceal them, and I'm currently dealing with the aftermath of that rabbit surplus right now around my place. I've been cutting a lot of brush, and every time I pile up some brush, it's quickly the home for a new rabbit. So anyway, that remains to be seen. In terms of your question about why are they hunted or trapped, they're a very important fur bearer. That fur that everyone finds attractive in seeing them is attractive in the fur industry. And they have a long history in Wisconsin of being one of the fur bearers that that is harvested. And the population is such that it can sustain that. The difficulty for someone who becomes attached to an individual fox is trying to grapple with, well, gee, you know, our fox here in the neighborhood, it's unfortunate that it might be subject to being caught by someone else or shot in the countryside or whatever. But the reality is that the foxes are managed on the basis of the size and security of their population over a large area or over the state. And that management strategy is designed to perpetuate foxes, but not necessarily to address the problems or needs of an individual fox that someone else like yourself might become attached to. So that's the reality of it. The population continues to thrive under harvest pressure and the other things that affect fox populations. And if you're lucky enough to get one in an urban area like that, they're usually safe from that particular problem, but not from cars and assorted other things. So,
all right. Well, thank you for your question, Jan. Good luck getting a fox back to your neighborhood. Let's go to Janie in Nakusa. Is it Nakusa?
Yes.
Okay. What's your question?
My question is, I saw an eagle go over our bridge yesterday. It was a juvenile eagle. We do have an eagle's nest here in Nakusa that I'm sure there's a lot of people watch it. What happens to that juvenile eagle if he's nesting there now when the male and female come back to build their nest and lay eggs? Where does he go? And is he in that nest right now? Where is he living?
Well, he's living in the area. That's about all. The nest is irrelevant this time of year. The nest tree, wherever it is, or nest site, is just another tree now. There's no reason for the bird to be in it. It doesn't provide any more shelter than any one of a gazillion other roost sites. And the adult pair, which may be down at Prairie du Sac or maybe down at the Realfoot Lake Refuge in Tennessee or somewhere along the Mississippi River between here and there, it's of no concern to them where that juvenile is. And even if it's a juvenile eagle that their nesting produced, and the nest is of no relevance to the juvenile until it finds a mate and becomes mature in 3 years and nests itself. So the fact that there's a juvenile there really has no bearing on either the nest or other eagles in the area and where it's living. It doesn't really have a home base. It's roosting in an appropriate spot there along the river, probably hunting in the river. Whether it will stay there for the entire winter or not, who knows?
Okay. Well, thank you, Janie. Thank you for that call. And let's go to Gary in Kenosha. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
What's your question?
Thank you so much. My question would be about the peregrine falcon, what kind of numbers there are here in southeastern Wisconsin, and if indeed I am correct in thinking there was a reintroduction program years ago in Milwaukee, there is a falcon-type bird that swoops around the bird feeder at my dad's, and it's pretty successful. We've seen them come away with the bird many times. So that would be the first thing. And second, with the last caller, also here on the west side of Kenosha, right in the city limits, very active fox coyote population. And then if we could jump over to turkeys, with a large number of turkeys in some parts of the state, as they forage through a region in the spring and whatnot, is that detrimental to ground nesting birds and other types of amphibians and reptiles and whatnot? And then just quickly, thank you. I was fortunate to see one time outside of Bozeman, Montana, there was a mule deer fawn that was taken down out in a pasture. And soon afterwards, and I mean very soon afterwards, eagles converged on it, consumed the whole thing down into bones and the hide within like 20, give it like 40 minutes. But there was several mature bald eagles and two golden eagles. So thank you so much for hearing me out.
Okay, thanks, Gary. He's got a list for you there, Scott.
Thank you, Gary. Well, let's take those in reverse order while I can remember them. The notion of large flocks of turkeys moving through an area, which they do tend to concentrate in huge groups during the winter especially, and then they spread out in the spring when the gobblers are less tolerant of each other and nesting is taking place. But a flock of turkeys moving through a field in warmer conditions, hey, if there's a garter snake out there in the open, it's going to be a snack for a turkey. But in terms of any population level impacts of turkey feeding on reptiles, amphibians, ground nesting birds, field rodents, or anything else, it may happen occasionally, but not a big deal. In terms of the fox and coyotes, the area you described, and especially along the lakeshore counties, have always been hotbeds of coyote activity for whatever reason. And then back to the hawk at your bird feeder. The odds are, I mean, obviously we don't have a picture of it, I can't see it, but the odds are greatly in favor of any hawk that's bothering your bird feeder right now being a Cooper's hawk. They've become quite common. They're very active around feeders, feeding on small birds. I see one about every 3 or 4 days come through my backyard, and the birds scatter until the Cooper's hawk has moved on. If they kind of set up residence around a bird feeder, that can be a very frustrating experience for someone who's trying to run an active feeding station. But there's not a great deal you can do about it other than let things play out. If the birds scatter or you stop feeding for a few days so that the birds scatter, the Cooper's hawk will usually move to better hunting grounds, and that's about all you can do. It's very unlikely that it's a peregrine falcon, which is still, although there are some around, not a common bird by any means, and they tend to be where they're nesting, concentrated on bluffs and cliffs and so forth along the Mississippi and Wisconsin and other such places. You are correct, however, that a few years ago, I don't know what the current status is, but I don't think there are any hacking sites. That was the term used for these nesting structures where peregrines were introduced or assisted in bringing off a clutch of young on some large buildings here in Madison and Milwaukee and some other sites. And it worked very well. I'm reluctant to use the bird-related term that the nests were hacked or hacking, given current situation in the news. That has kind of a negative connotation, but that's what it was called. But if you want to check on the current status of where some of these birds are and what's going on, I would go to the DNR's Natural Heritage website, formerly the Bureau of Endangered Resources, and I suspect there's a place where you can click on or enter search for peregrine falcons and see just exactly what's going on in the state right now. So,
okay,
there you have it.
Wow, that was quite a list, Scott. Good job. Timothy on Facebook actually said that several years ago, a neighbor of his got threatened with fines for feeding deer carcasses to eagles. The warden said it would cause the eagles to become dependent on this as a food source. However, he has heard you, Scott, speak of doing this very thing. So which is it, a fine or a good photo op?
Well, I've never advocated putting out deer carcasses to feed the eagles. I indicated that a deer carcass along the road or elsewhere to a hunter is a potential food source, but it's a potential food source for virtually everybody out there in the wildlife community. It's not just deer. First of all, I would question where someone would be getting deer carcasses to feed to the eagles, because that might be a bigger problem for the individual from a wildlife law enforcement standpoint. But generally speaking, I don't want to open the feeding can of worms now unless we have to. But generally speaking, feeding any of these wild animals has some real downsides to it, whether it's eagles or deer themselves or turkeys or anything else. And there are legal constraints against that in many cases because of the disease problem when it comes to deer and a lot of other things. Even people taking to throwing fish carcasses to the eagles on a given lake so that they can get a good photo op or tame them down a little bit is questionable. And in some cases, wardens will interpret that as an illegal activity. So people have to be a little careful, but putting out deer carcasses intentionally to feed the eagles is not something that would be recommended for people who have the remains of a butchered carcass after the deer season, and they own enough land where their disposal method may be to put it out on the back 40. What eats it, and that's not something that's necessarily directed at feeding. It's more of a disposal issue.
Sure. Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Carol in Appleton. Hi, Carol. You have a question?
Hi, Jill. While I was waiting, I almost had a complete change in what I was going to ask about. My goodness.
Okay.
Well, we have a wooded lot in the middle of the city with lots of bird feeders and usually lots of activity. And then the last 3 days, there wasn't a bird anywhere. And now, while I was waiting online, I thought, well, what could this be? Because we've had Cooper's hawks, and they usually, the birds come back in a short while. But maybe hawks hang around for days and days and days. But then all of a sudden, here I am online, and like everything in the world has come back to the backyard. I'm looking at woodpeckers, and I've even got one of those big ones with the big red head at the back of the head, and then there are little ones where there's a pair where the male has a little red dot at the back, and then I've got house finches and goldfinches and nuthatch and I'm just amazed about all the stuff that is suddenly and there was no activity for two whole days, and there's some chickadees right now, and well, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, but there was, like about a week ago, there was actually blood out on the snow.
Okay.
So I know that there's something that sees this as a bounty, and occasionally, because I've actually seen the Cooper hawk.
Okay, Carol. Well, let's let Scott address that. You know, it could be those birds are coming back because they knew you were on the radio, Scott, and they could hear it at Carol's
That
house.
Could be it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly possible that a Cooper's hawk or multiple Cooper's hawks might set up shop at a particularly productive feeder for an extended period. And over the years, I used to have people call it. The Cooper's hawk was there almost all the time for weeks on end, and it really impeded their ability to keep their feeding station active. So that might be part of it. But I think there's also a weather factor. You know, the few days that you were talking about, not many birds, it was pretty warm, relatively speaking. It was above freezing. The rain took out a lot of our snow, so all of a sudden there was open ground where birds could forage on their own. Things were exposed that hadn't been. And then all of a sudden, there's an Arctic blast coming in. The birds know this, probably better than some of our meteorological computer programs, and all of a sudden, okay, guys, it's time to stock up. It's going to get really cold, or there's a storm coming, or whatever. So I think the weather patterns we've had, coupled with maybe the presence of a Cooper's hawk, explain what happened. But the fact is, your birds are back now, so all's well that ends well. Enjoy the feeder, keep it filled, and keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you, Carol. Hope that helped you. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And Scott Craven is our guest. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Do you have questions for him? We have a few open lines. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow at this time, our consumer protection experts will be back with us, and we're going to talk about data breaches and tax preparation fraud. So I hope you can join us for that. Right now, we're talking with Scott Craven. And Scott, you wanted to mention, well, the deer hunt has finally wrapped up. Seems like it goes on forever.
Well, and it's still on, actually.
Is it?
The last day is July 8th, which may be this Saturday, and that's the end
you
of
mean
the
January
archery season.
8th?
January.
Thank
Did I
you.
Say July?
You said July.
Oh, God,
it
no. It doesn't go that long. January 8th, this coming weekend, will be the final day
okay.
of the archery season, which is the last season to end. And
okay.
that will be the end of it.
Wow. That's
so,
a lot.
But
yeah.
the big, although there's certainly a tremendous amount of interest in archery hunting now, and that's been accentuated by the legal use of crossbows for the past couple of years. The gold standard for the deer season, when somebody says deer season, mm-hmm. they're still generally talking about the 9-day period surrounding Thanksgiving from Saturday to Sunday. And that season did come to an end with the weekend after Thanksgiving, and there's been a lot of talk and hand-wringing about whether things were good, bad, or indifferent in terms of the harvest. There was a slight downturn in the overall harvest. Generally, it was pretty similar to past years, but the main harvest index that the DNR is concerned about is the buck kill, and that was at a point, again, comparable to recent years, but down from years gone by, and it causes a little bit of hand-wringing. But I think the bigger change in this deer season was another decline in the number of licenses sold for the gun deer season. And that's maybe of more concern as we seem to lose deer hunters. Less deer hunters in the woods is obviously going to convert to less deer taken over time. On the bright side, things rebounded in the north, as was expected. That herd had been greatly depressed for a few years due to bad weather and a variety of other factors, and that did bounce back, and the buck kill went up there, and people seem to generally be happy about that. But the fact that the harvest has been somewhat stable to a few recent declines is of a little bit of management concern, and the license sale issue is another concern. But the northern rebound was on the bright side, and there were lots of in the southern part of the state, lots of large bucks taken, so that I think has captured hunters' interest. In my own case, hunting with my son, oh, I don't know how many deer we saw while we were in the woods, but I would say at least 50 or 60% of the deer we saw were antlered bucks, and quite a few of them were mature antlered bucks, and that is such a change from 15 or 20 or 30 years ago. It's really quite amazing, and in some cases, hard to figure out. That has some implications for chronic wasting disease, I guess, on the downside. All the testing results haven't been summarized yet, but there's been almost a steady increase over the years since chronic wasting disease was discovered in 2002. In terms of the infection rate and the geographic spread of that disease. So that's still a bit of a dark cloud over the deer season. But overall, the harvest was good. People seem to be relatively happy, and I think they're getting used to the many management changes that were implemented over the last few years as a result of the deer trustee report submitted, I think it was in 2012. So people are getting used to some of those changes. There's a committee now addressing chronic wasting disease again and hopefully coming forth with some recommendations on perhaps how to better handle that a bit. So overall, if in fact the speculation that some hunters switching over to archery equipment or particularly crossbows explains some of the decline in the sale of gun deer licenses, then, you know, maybe that's not the issue. Some people might think it is, but overall, it was another good deer season. It was a relatively safe one, and people are now processing venison and figuring out new ways to cook it and so forth. And if Larry ever comes back to his program, we'll talk about some recipes for deer cooking. So.
Well, I will make a note of that to put that on for the next time you're here, Scott. So let's, speaking of deer, let's go to Mark in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Mark. What's your question?
Yeah, I would like to know and I pretty much know the answer, but the use of non-toxic loads for hunting deer, because I have seen deer feasting on, or not deer, but birds feasting on the gut piles when I harvested deer. This is in far northern Wisconsin. And how much more we should try to promote that, because the differences in price for premium ammunition between the copper loads and the lead loads is minimal, and how to encourage more people to use non-toxic rifle ammunition.
Well, a very good question and a long and involved topic, but I'll try and produce the Reader's Digest version here, since you seem to know about it anyway. The reality of the situation is that I think we're just on a very slow path to eventually replacing all lead ammunition with some non-toxic alternative. The way we've already gone with waterfowl hunting, with dove hunting on public lands, and with a variety of other things. And I think hunters will eventually catch on to that, although that I think ultimately it will be some sort of regulation that simply eventually cuts it out. Existing supplies are used or dispersed, and we're using all non-toxic ammunition. That may be years and years away. I don't know, but I think it will happen. And anyone who's resisting it, the issues are tradition. While you're right that in the premium ammunition, the high-end ammunition, the monolithic or solid copper is roughly comparable to high-end lead-based loads, or however you want to think of it, the price difference is not great, a few dollars on a $40 or $50 box, but it's at the other end of the spectrum where the 30-30, 308, and 30-06 lower-end ammunition, which still performs well in terms of someone using it in the field, is on sale for $18, $19, $20 a box when the deer season rolls around. That's a big attraction for some folks, and realistically, some deer hunters only fire one or two rounds a year, if that. So a box of shells is going to last them a long, long time. But anybody who's seen a demonstration of what a lead load fired into a blob of ballistic gel does, which is a simulation of what it does in the tissue of a deer versus a copper load, and you realize how many tiny, tiny particles of lead are dispersing into the tissue where you would never find them or notice them as you're processing. That stuff is being ingested not just by the wildlife that you see scavenging on a gut pile or the remains of a carcass, but it's also, in some cases, ending up on the dinner table in a chop or a roast. And it becomes a matter of, I don't say personal preference, but personal concern over how much of an issue that is for themselves or their family or whatever else. So the long and short of it is, I think we're on a slow path toward replacing it with whatever non-toxic alternative people gravitate toward, probably copper, I guess, but it's going to take a long time. So,
Scott, is it something that maybe people who have had the lead shot for a while could maybe donate to one of the the classes? Is that something that they use on that? Do they actually, use shot at all? Or
you mean
the training classes?
Training classes? Mm-hmm. Well, it's possible, and I suppose there are places where lead can be used and recovered, for example, on a shooting range, mm-hmm. where it can be reclaimed or what have you. But it's really its use in hunting that is the issue. There are some places, California, for example, where they're protecting condors and whatnot, where it has been banned. And, it's like anything else. People need to get, that's a quantum change for many hunters, and people need to get used to it. The difficulty right now is that ammunition, as you're probably aware, has been, seems like a harsh term, but I'll use the term hoarded for lack of a better one. Stockpiled is maybe
there
a better term.
Stockpiled. Okay.
Lots of people, for a variety of reasons, have been buying and storing lots and lots of ammunition. Mm. So even if for some reason, who knows what, there was a decree tomorrow that, all right, that's it. No more lead-based ammunition is going to be manufactured. existing stocks can be used up. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a tremendous standing stock out there. So, and we're not going to see a decree like that anyway, so it's probably not worth speculating on. So there are some inherent problems, but I think just as we've seen it kind of go incrementally, eventually it will all be gone. But it could be a long,
could
long
be a
time.
While. All right. Well, thank you for all that information. And thank you for asking the question, Mark. Let's go to Denise in Cedarburg. And got a little time before we go to break. What's your question, Denise?
I recently moved to a rural area in Cedarburg, and I'd like to attract birds. There were a couple empty feeders here when I moved in. I've filled them, and I'm kind of waiting for birds to come, but I haven't had any activity. It's been a week now, and I'm just wondering if you can tell me when I could expect to see some birds discovering my feeders.
I would say between 2:30 and 3 o'clock. I'm just kidding. It really depends on a lot of things. If the feeders have been empty for a while, birds become very tuned in to a regimen of, okay, we're going to visit this feeder at this time of day. And once they're coming, and they will come, then you'll notice who comes when. Cardinals tend to come late in the day and so forth. But just quickly, it depends a little bit on what's going on around you. If some of the neighbors have very active feeding stations, it'll take the birds a little longer. And with the warm weather we just had, that may have delayed it. So keep those feeders filled. A little water would be a great attractant, but that's kind of difficult now that it's gotten so cold. Keep the feeders filled. Spread some seed around on the snow or on the deck where they can see it or find it. Once they find it, they'll be there.
Okay. If you put it out, they will come.
They will come,
yes.
Yep.
We've been talking with Scott Craven. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. If you've got any questions, please give us a call. Right now, we're going to go to the news, and we'll be back right afterwards. Well, it's the first Wednesday of the month, so that means we're talking about wildlife. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm filling in for Larry today. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. Scott Craven is with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And, of course, he's here every other month to answer your questions. So have you had any problems with wildlife damaging your property over the winter? Or what questions do you have for Scott? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And don't forget, you can post on our Facebook page. Now, Scott, there was a couple of things that we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of what the year was like for wildlife last year?
Well, in watching the weather the other night, I was just taken by the fact that it seemed to be a warm year. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was the sixth warmest on record. I don't want to get into what that means for climate change or who believes it or who doesn't. But in any event, it was a warm year.
Uh-huh.
And that's generally a good thing as far as wildlife is concerned. It was also, I thought, gee, it rained a lot. Well, it did.
Yes,
it was the
fourth
wettest year
in
record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting, I didn't even know we kept records back this far, but it was the wettest year since the 1880s. Not the 1980s, the 1880s. Almost 140 years ago. So it was clearly wet.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line was that meant a lot of stuff grew really well. It was warm, it was wet. It was good for vegetation, and therefore, with the water on the landscape, good for a lot of animals that use the water, amphibians and some reptiles and small mammals and the rabbits we mentioned earlier.
Right.
A good year for a lot of things, and it led to a lot of food being out as we head into winter here and it starts to get colder. On the subject of it getting colder, most of the state has good snow cover. Our snow around here is now hard, frozen, and miserable, but we'll get snow here. And I just wanted to plug the notion of people who call and they're interested in wildlife, what's out on their property, what can they do on a cold day when there's nothing else to do. Head outside and find the trail or tracks of some animal and follow them.
Right. That's
a winter tracking is kind of a neat thing to do. You can first figure out, the how of it is dress for the weather and go outside and find some animal tracks. Follow your dog around if you want, but you'll learn a lot about what the animals are doing. People have asked you, where are these things living? Well, get out and follow the tracks, and you'll find out exactly where they're living and what they're doing and maybe what they're eating and how far they're moving. Are they going to the neighbors? Where are they? So it's kind of a neat hobby in the winter. It's good exercise. It gets you outside. It can lead to, if you really get turned on by it, you can get involved in citizen science programs that involve wildlife tracking to collect information on the wolf population in the northern part of the state and other such things. And there are field guides to wildlife tracks. There are little fact sheets with wildlife tracks on them. It's kind of a neat thing to do.
And there's probably an app for that, right?
Yeah, there probably is, now that you mention it.
Yep.
And the only other thing I wanted to be sure to mention was an interesting little news article I ferreted out the other day that indicated that the Chinese government is, I would say finally, but it doesn't matter. They're making efforts to end at least what they can do to end the legal ivory trade.
Right.
In African elephant ivory. And so they'll phase out the legal trade and processing in China by the end of this year, by the end of 2017. And there still is some legal processing because they've made large purchases for control programs and pre-whatever the date was, I think it was in the 1980s. There's still some ivory around that's legal. But, of course, the biggest problem is poaching.
Right.
And that finds its way into this legal loophole in China. This should be really good news for the African elephant. Now, the downside, I guess, is that people will be people, and this may just push things underground and the black market and so forth. But this is a step in the right direction. It's good news, and it's coming up here in the coming year. So, hey, that's a positive thing to talk about.
Absolutely.
And then lastly, if we're well into winter now, if people are having trouble around the house with mice and things getting in, good luck with that.
Well, thank you, Scott.
No, the bottom helpful. Line is there are things that I say that because
we've
I
all
get
been
it
there.
At home. We've got a shrew in the garage and a little dark charcoal animal. And as far as my wife is concerned, if it's furry and not a squirrel, it's a rat. And they're not rats. I go to great lengths to try and clarify this because a shrew is not a problem in the garage. They're in there eating the mice that are a problem. So protect your shrews and get rid of your mice and everybody will be happy.
Well, you should start a movement. Protect your shrew. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Bill in Milwaukee, you had a question. Hi, Bill.
Hello. It's a good show.
Thank you.
I live in Milwaukee on the east side, right near the Lake Michigan, and we've got, heavily wooded bluffs that go up for, 50 miles up the shore, so there's a lot of wildlife. And we had coyotes and lots of foxes. They'd be walking down the sidewalk in the winter, and all of a sudden they all disappeared. And I know things go in cycles, but could there have been like a secret trapping program or someone poisoning them, that they all disappeared, sort of?
Well, maybe. I don't think there was any kind of secret government-led conspiracy to get rid of those animals, although there are some cases where there are formal programs to remove coyotes that are particularly problematic, say with dog depredation or something like that. But much as we were just talking about the ivory trade and people being people, for folks who are less tolerant of mid-sized predators like that in the environment, they could have been removed that way. Could have been vehicle mortality. We're coming up on, it may not seem like it, but we're right on the cusp of the breeding season for some of these animals, particularly red fox and great horned owls and some of the things that reproduce very early, seemingly in midwinter. And that sometimes adjusts their movements and behavior as well. So I wouldn't necessarily, the fact that something isn't being seen usually causes concern that something bad happened, but that may not be the case. They may have, because of food source or upcoming breeding season or whatever else, simply changed their patterns a little bit. And if you liked seeing them around, I would suggest that that's what you go with for a plausible explanation. And because there are good populations of both of those animals in that area you describe along the lakeshore is a very good wildlife corridor, some animal will be back. Whether it's the same one or not, who knows? But they'll be back.
Okay. Well, keep your eyes open there, Bill. Let's go to Liz in Walworth. Hi, Liz. What question do you have for Scott?
Thank you, Joe and Scott, for taking my call. And I just want to say that I am actually Walworth Village Township, and I live near Delavan Lake. And I've got wooded areas around us here. And a couple late winter, early spring, about 2 years ago, I was looking out my back patio doors onto my backyard, and by my bird feeder, there was a whole flock of birds, and they were all, there was about 25 of them, and they were all the same color. There was no females. I believe they, after I zoomed in on the picture I took of them, I believe they were indigo buntings. But it was kind of unusual because there was no females with them. And they had to be all males from the way they looked. From the eyesight, from my eyesight without binoculars or anything, they looked all like they had completely blue bodies. They were about 4 or 5 inches, about 5 inches, and they had looked like they all had black hooded heads. But as I zoomed in on the picture, they looked more like indigo buntings. Were they coming back from, like, the south and just came in a bunch or into a group or what?
Wow, that's a tricky one. Indigo buntings are not all that common. They are all blue. They're beautiful little birds, but they're not typically a feeder bird. I've never seen more than one at any one time, so that's really kind of strange. But so the birds you saw were distinctively blue.
Definitely, yeah.
All blue, no light color or rust color on the belly, so they weren't bluebirds.
No, they were bluebirds. I got a pretty good look at them, and then, of course, the picture I took, I zoomed it in. I actually did try to email Larry's program, but at the time I couldn't send him a picture of it. But I do have a picture, and they were beautiful birds. I thought I was looking at a new species at first.
Well, Liz, can you maybe email that?
So you're familiar with birds. Say a junco. You're familiar with a junco or a chickadee?
Yeah.
And these blue birds you saw were about that size, or they were bigger?
They were about the size of a little bigger than a chickadee. A little bigger, I would say.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's really a cool sighting, and I'd be very curious to see if you still have the picture, if you can figure out some way to get it to Larry's Facebook page or emailed or something else. I'd be happy to take a look at it and share it with some friends and figure out exactly what you saw. There aren't many options. We don't have many blue blue birds around here, so... it would be very interesting to see what you actually had there.
Liz, maybe you can send it to talk@wpr.org, and I'll make sure that Scott gets that, okay?
Okay, I'll do that. I'll do my best. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Liz.
Thank you very much.
And Scott, speaking of birds, we have a couple of pictures.
That's a great picture.
Isn't that a beautiful picture? Mary actually posted this. She wants to know, is it a Cooper's or a sharp-skinned hawk? And it's near Mosinee, and it's a beautiful picture of this bird catching another one.
Not so much for the bird on the bottom there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at that. Cooper's... So goshawks, coopers, and sharp-shinned are all very similar in appearance and separated as much by size as anything else. I'm seeing some black and white, I think, on the wing that looks like a woodpecker to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On the bottom. And because they're a reasonably sizable bird, I'm going to go with Cooper's hawk.
Okay.
The sharp-shinned is a very small version of that. And while it's possible, it wouldn't be... And, you know, they're a bit bigger than a blue jay. So size comparison there and just on probabilities. And that's a goshawk. Not a goshawk. Cooper's hawk and a very unfortunate woodpecker.
Okay. All right. And then we had another one. Patricia posted this. She said the bird hit her window this morning and she was wondering what it was. Can you tell from that picture? It's kind of dark.
Well, let me
get a little closer to the screen.
Up here.
So Scott's perusing it real close to see what it is. It's, like I said, it's a little bit dark.
It's the same thing.
It's another hawk,
okay. And it was probably chasing a bird and hit the window as the bird was evading it. So based on the size of the bricks there, which are normal construction bricks, I think it's another Cooper's hawk that hit the window and is probably just recovering. It's upright and seems to be alert. So usually they just kind of stay still for a while and come around and say, what the heck was that? and away they go.
Shake it off. All right. Well, so the answer today is Cooper's hawk. All right. Let's go to Dave in Cudahy. Hi, Dave. You had a question for Scott.
Yes. It's a DNR question involving hunting dogs. I seem to recall reading an article when they were using dogs to hunt bears, which I am really opposed to. And if a bear happened to kill one of these dogs, the owner was entitled to reimbursement.
That's correct.
Thousands of dollars. I'm wondering if I'm accurate on that.
So far, you are completely accurate.
How can I stop this? You have a pet. You're putting that pet in danger, and there's a certain assumption of risk that goes along with this.
Well, that's very true, and that's the crux of the debate over this particular issue. Dogs are widely used, packs of hounds, to pursue bears. In some cases, other things. There was a great deal of controversy, you may recall, when the wolf season was in place and maybe again in the future, and there was a discussion over whether dogs would be allowed to pursue wolves, which also clearly puts the dogs in harm's way, as does bear hunting. But that's that is part of the inherent risk. The dog owners know that. I suspect they're not particularly happy about it, but it goes with the territory. And there has been a history of compensation for lost hunting dogs in the state. And I don't know what to tell you. As I say, it has, bear hunting has a long tradition in Wisconsin. It's bear hunters are passionate about it. They're well organized. And this is something that's been in place for a long time. The issue of being supportive or not supportive about dogs being used in the first place is one issue. The issue of compensation when the dogs are clearly in a dangerous situation is another issue entirely. And you asked me what you can do about it personally, and I have no particular suggestion other than you're certainly free to exercise the options you have to open this debate at the Spring Conservation Congress hearings, which are open to everyone, to potentially appear as a citizen before the DNR Natural Resources Board and offer your thoughts on this matter, or to contact your various representatives in terms of legislature. And anyone, you or anyone else, is free to offer your thoughts on this matter and see where they take you. I do not think you're the only one who perhaps feels this way, so that's another way to pursue the matter. But as I say, it has a rich tradition. Bear hunting with dogs is likely to continue in Wisconsin. The issue of compensation is somewhat separate from the practice itself.
Okay.
So there you have it.
Well, thank you for the question, Dave. And let's go to Cindy in Belleville. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Jill. Thanks. Scott, I often hear people talking about small critters such as ground squirrels, chipmunks, going into hibernation. But I know you've talked in the past about the difference between true hibernation and those animals that are winter sleepers, I think you've called them. I was wondering if you could give us a refresher on that difference.
We don't have very many true hibernators. The ground squirrels, for example, or woodchucks that go down in the fall, and there are major physiological changes in those animals. Their heart rate slows, their body temperature diminishes, their respiration goes down. They're essentially out of it, so to speak, and they're down kind of for the duration. As opposed to, I guess, the most notorious winter sleeper is probably bear. And you know, to get at the specifics of how the physiological measurements change, I think the easiest, if you're really curious about the details, I hate to even use the term, but I'm going to say Google it, or
we'll forgive
you know,
you,
use whatever reference source you like. But at that point, you can get a list of some of the species that fall into both categories, and it will tell you very clearly what some of the changes are and their ability to kind of come out of their sleep, so to speak, over the course of the winter. I think that in the little time that we have available and the complexity of that issue, I think a little homework would be in order and provide you with the information you want.
Okay. Well, have fun researching that, Cindy. Let's go to Tom in Rhinelander. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for the show. Always enjoy Scott. My wife and I were out in the woods Sunday grouse hunting about a mile back in the woods. There's about 10 inches of snow on the ground with a crust about halfway down, and I was wondering how grouse get grit for their gizzards in the winter, or if they actually need it.
Of more concern to the grouse is probably the amount of crust on the snow that you described, in that maybe, depending on how close it is to the surface, prevents them from snow roosting, which is important for them in really cold weather. But as far as the grit's concerned, I'm guessing that they get whatever they need along the roadsides. Even if they're way back in and not getting anywhere near a road, that may be a little more problematic. But most grouse are, you know, within the area of a snowmobile trail, a woods road, or whatever, where there's a little piece of that trail that may be on a south-facing slope, and there's just enough melting or sun activity or sanding of the road or a cut bank or whatever where they can find a little bit of grit.
Okay, interesting question. I never would have thought about that. Let's go to Bob in Crivitz. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. You were talking about indigo buntings a little while ago. Okay, my cabin's right off at Calderon Falls. I'm west of Crivitz, about 20 miles. I get them up here all the time. Okay, and I'm positive they're indigo buntings.
Hmm.
Okay, and the other comment I have, both my wife and I are big bird watchers. Okay, I worked at Edgewater Generating Station in Sheboygan for 31 years, and we put a box up on top of the building for peregrine falcons.
Yep.
Okay, and I was in a room down there. We had a meeting going on, and they came in there with the three chicks, and they were banding them and taking blood tests. That's the clumsiest looking funny bird I've ever seen when they're small.
You wonder with a lot of birds how they ever grow up to be as graceful and as well plumaged as they are, but that's the way it is with baby animals.
Well, it was terrific to watch them hunting, though. I operated heavy equipment, so I saw them out there along the beach a lot of times going after pigeons. It was just a neat thing to see. So,
thank you.
Thanks,
yeah,
Scott.
You're welcome.
Just real quick before we go here, Scott, Josh emailed that he's got a woodpecker after his mature cherry tree, and he wants to get it off of there. Do you have any tips for him to chase away that woodpecker?
If that's happening now, I mean, the common problem is yellow-bellied sapsuckers in the warmer season, but if it's a woodpecker after a tree now, there's something wrong with the tree. And therefore, there's a bigger problem going on, and especially with a cherry tree that's prone to black knot and a variety of other problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the only thing he can really do, other than hanging a scare eye balloon or something that might disrupt it for a few days, is wrap the affected area and keep the bird off of it.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again for stopping by, Scott. We really appreciate that. We've been talking to Scott Craven. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I want to thank Brandy Funk for on-air production and Dave Potras for technical direction. And tomorrow at this time, our consumer protection experts will be back to talk about data breaches and tax preparation fraud. So hope you can join us for that. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I've been sitting in for Larry Mueller, who's a little under the weather. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. There's more to come. Stay with us.